Welcome to the IAB UK podcast.
Hello, James here, bringing you your weekly instalment of the IAB UK podcast. This week's episode is a live recording from April's Last Thursday Club, where we put premium publishers in the spotlight for a fascinating and timely discussion about cookieless targeting, the role of professional journalism today, and why context really does matter when it comes to how your ads are perceived. Behind the mics, Camilla Child, Director of Commercial Data Strategy at Telegraph Media Group, Alistair Smith, Head of Commercial Data and Insight at The Independent, and repping the agency view, Mick Clare, Head of Partnerships at Group M. I got the conversation going by asking them for their reactions to the recent news that third-party cookies won't be exiting stage right on Chrome this year.
I don't think any of us are surprised it's been delayed again. It was first mentioned in 2020 to be done by 2022. Now it's, what's 23? What's 24? Now it's going to be 25.
Yeah.
So you do get used to it, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
There is a bit of a frustration that comes with it that most publishers will have spent, like we have, maybe 3 or so years planning for that, whether that's building up your first-party declared data, registered users, your emails, sorting out all your first-party audiences, building them in the most correct way to get accuracy and scale. So it's a huge opportunity for us to actually bring out quality, consistent audiences at scale that meet advertisers and agencies' needs. But yes,
it sounds like you're raring to go now.
It is frustrating, and you do understand the needs, because this has been delayed mainly because the Competition and Markets Authority have said that they believe the solutions of Google privacy needs their work and may be in favour of Google at the minute. But certainly the privacy element of being able to turn off third-party cookies can happen.
Yeah.
It's only 30% of the digital ecosystem now. Safari, Firefox, they've already gone.
Yeah.
So it's significant, but there's still 70% of the kind of ecosystem that is living without them now.
Yeah.
So it isn't doomsday.
Yeah,
we just want to get going.
Nice positive take on it. I mean, you've been at this 5 years. Remember Nick Hugh making a really big standing up and saying this is a massive priority for what we're doing at the Telegraph around first party data, around subscribers. So level of preparedness is very, very high for you guys.
Hopefully. yes, exactly. I think with the strategy that we've been on as a business, moving to a subscriptions model back in 2018, it really has been part and parcel of everything. The journey we've been on, getting to 1 million plus subscribers in that time, and first-party data is obviously a huge benefit of having that really close relationship with our readers and those logged-in users coming to our site that we can understand holistically across all their devices and browsers. So we've been collecting all of that first-party data, as Ali said, but also working on how all of those data points work together to create advertising solutions, really, over the last few years.
Yeah. And what's the Group M, what's the agency land take, Mick?
I think, once again, no big surprise. And to the point, like, this isn't a new topic, being cookieless. That started since 2013.
Yeah.
So I think what's been good about it, by having these deadlines, is the fact that it's brought it to front of mind of clients. Coming front of mind is testing all these solutions that are out in market. That testing is going to take a period of time. I think it's important, if it's to be late and right rather than necessarily just rushing into it. Yes, it's disappointing, and I completely understand the reasons why that's disappointing. But from a client perspective, I suppose it's good that we are at a point, having had these deadlines, where we are testing and proceeding with quite a few things.
What's your sense of, and I don't want you to talk about specifics, but level of preparedness across clients? Is it a real spectrum? Some are there and are testing solutions at work, others maybe at a different place in the journey?
Yeah, I mean, from a group point of view, if you think about, we've been part of that key initiative, the privacy sandbox.
Yeah.
What's interesting now is the amount of different solutions that are coming out in market. And you've also got to think about the measurement, if you think about, like, cross channels as well. So, you know, what's the measurement solution you're actually looking for? And not just in display, but how this cookieless, you know, how things are playing out within the audio environments across AV as well. And I think from a client perspective, it's just about how you get ready and start to test. Like, we've seen, like, I mentioned Google, but you've got DSPs that are bringing out their cookieless solutions, the likes of Publishers and the Ozone project and their identity solution. And even at Group M, like, we're exploring with Choreograph and Resolve, the cohort-based strategy as we move forward. through that.
Let's touch on, mentioned Ozone there. Why do you think Ozone's worked? I've seen a number of JVs. There was a JV between mobile providers that kind of worked and failed. TV tried it, Project Kangaroo tried it. Ozone have pulled it off. They've managed to get these competitors to all work together and everyone seems to be winning. Why do you think that's happened?
Yeah, well, it did seem like a really big thing at the time when we kicked it off. Telegraph was one of the founding fathers, I think I described it before. I'm not sure if that's the right metaphor at all. Founding people, founding friends.
Yes.
So we were there at the beginning and now it's obviously grown and flourished and has so many more publishers as part of it. But we're really proud of that success and how it's working for us as a really robust replacement, as it were, to the OMP that works in favour of publishers. I think, to your point, a key differentiator is that it was begun and conceived by those publishers, by those teams, by those groups who are working on this from the beginning. So it's always been created in the interest of those publishers to meet advertiser demand, and also that they've built all of their own technology from the ground up. It really is a tech layer built by and for publishers. Yeah. So
No one came in and imposed their thing to come and use our tech. It genuinely was an agnostic.
Exactly, yeah. Yes. So I think it had a different sort of mentality from the beginning, and those different constituent parts, I think, is key.
Yeah. And it's not a kind of a binary choice, Ali. It's not, I'm using Ozone, therefore I'm not working directly with publishers. Of course, there's a nice sort of hybrid that exists there as well. You can still go deep with the partners if you want to.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you can do direct with a partner, you can't do as well as display, the optimization of the areas, and using data throughout planning, optimization, and reporting to create those bespoke audiences as well that fit clients' needs.
Yeah.
But from a real scale kind of buying and ease of buying, that's where Ozone really brings it in. But in that kind of bespoke, kind of niche kind of way of working one-on-one with a partner, those campaigns work fantastically, but the scale that and ease that Ozone offers is an extra layer.
Yeah, you've got a really interesting take on first party data, saying that all first party data is not born equal. Tell us a bit about that.
No, exactly. First party data gets thrown around quite a bit, and one huge thing that I want to talk about is declared first party data. I've heard it called zero party data, which I absolutely despise. Oh, I don't know who comes up with these.
Maybe the author's in the room.
Yeah. But declared first party data is the huge value. Declared first party data is when a user gives you their information. That could be their email address, their phone number, or even their demographics when they register or subscribe with ourselves, really. That's allowing a lot of the publisher to advertiser technology that's out there, whether it's clean rooms, publisher to advertiser, even some of the ID solutions that are coming out, really. And the difference is it isn't inferred. That's come from the source itself, really, to directly the people that you're going to communicate to, really. And obviously, advertisers are building up their declared data, their customer user base, and publishers are through subscriptions and registered users. And you're going to create some really nice kind of matches that you can. And there's some great technology out there. Some not so great technology, but they'll be weaned out, I think, in time.
You like the term matching rather than share.
Yeah, I think it's an important distinction to make. I think there's a bit of a paradigm shift at the moment of moving from centralised data control to more decentralised, and how we start to match, and obviously those privacy concerns. We need to be responsible, I think. Like when we're talking about cookieless, that's reacting to the market and consumers, like they want to protect their privacy, and we need to be respectable and responsible for that. So moving much more to that kind of more decentralised matching solution. And I think the more we talk about matching data sets as opposed to sharing, because that term sharing, I think, rings alarm bells. So I'd like us to shift that language more towards that matching of data sets.
Yeah. It may seem obvious, but the sort of key differences between this declared first-party data and what you can glean from third-party cookies. Talk us a bit through that.
Definitely. We've built our whole data proposition around first-party data, again, off the back of everything we've done as a business. And so it's absolutely key, I think, for us, in addition to everything that Ali said around the declared data versus inferred. With third-party data, you would never get the level of transparency. You would never actually know where it was come from, what it represented, you know, what it was composed of. So I think that transparency element is so important, but also the ability to identify people. You can know so much on somebody, but if you really have that holistic understanding of the person, so we leverage our Telegraph proprietary IDs as much as possible to sync together all the different data points that we have on our readers, our audiences, and understanding them in the round. Again, there's first-party data that can be disparate across cookies, across different platforms, devices, but when you can actually bring it all together and have that complete picture of who someone is and give them the best possible experience on your platform, on your site, on the app or wherever, but also giving brands the best possible access to that person, whether that's through effective targeting or really effective frequency capping. You can only do it when you get down to that level, at that level of effectiveness, I think.
And is that going broader than device as well? So it could be what people are listening to, what they're reading. Just having this single view is so important.
Yeah, audio is something that we're definitely looking to expand into more. Yeah. I think that's such an exciting growth area too, of how people are engaging with content differently. But again, it all comes back to how well you can identify and understand a person. And also the level of engagement that you're able to draw. Do you have a first party audience, but they might be fly by night people that you never necessarily see again, or if you don't know that it's them? Or do you have a really loyal, engaged audience who have that affinity with you that you understand so much more about, and you can give them a better experience? You can also give brands a better experience interacting with those people too.
Yeah, and you only really get that from first party. You talked about audio there. Ad spend was out this week, audio up 23%, fastest growing medium, massive number for digital out of home as well. Omnichannel, we've been talking about a lot. It's sort of it's having its moment of resurgence again, and really important for you guys in terms of how you look at it as well, particularly post-cookie.
Yeah, I think if you look from a client perspective, it's exciting. The more and more channels that move digitally, obviously we're seeing like big disruption in the AV market.
Yeah.
I think clients are increasingly looking for omni-channel solutions. Within Nexus Media Solutions, we've got a cross-channel proposition as well. Increasingly, that's gaining traction and interest from clients. And what clients are looking for is less siloed approaches and how you can build like audiences and cohorts across media and not just be specifically siloed into one media. And that's where we're developing, like with Choreograph and Resolve, trying to look at that and think about how do we start to build holistic audiences that can work across multi-channels.
Yeah,
that's obviously the holy grail of what we're trying to get to. Yeah. And where we want to work is think about making every ad experience work harder as we move forward.
Yeah. And is that from a targeting as well as a measurement point of view? Because I think lots of the post-cookie narrative is actually around the measurement bit, but the targeting bit is equally as important.
Equally important, I would say.
Yeah. What about examples? Maybe we talk a lot about, or I read a lot about cookie apocalypse and doom and gloom and less of the opportunity of these things, but there's some great examples. Are there any examples that you guys have got that you've worked on so far that are success stories? But you, Ali?
Yeah, I'm talking on that publisher to advertiser kind of one-on-one relationship where matching audiences together. We've got two huge different examples from the different ways of how you can be flexible in audience matching. Obviously, you can take an advertiser's customer database, their email addresses, match them with our registered users, and you enrich with that match two hugely valuable data points, really. And when we did this for a broadcaster, we saw our largest brand uplift study that we'd ever had in 4 or 5 years of using that technology, just like that.
Yeah.
And then a second example, which I thought was quite neat, it wasn't my idea, so but I'll take it today, edit that out. But when someone matches audiences together, but then doesn't target that audience, you use that seed data to build a lookalike audience of what new prospecting consumers could look like. Mm. And we did that with a mobile provider, and they saw that despite them doubling their CPM, their CPA halved.
So incredible. Like, we've got all these solutions that are actually working better than the cookie environment.
Absolutely. But because you know your ingredients that you're putting in it, you're not buying a ready-made thing that you chuck in and then you throw that in. You know the exact ingredients that are going in, or you know what to include and when not to include it, exactly. So it turns out that putting quality ingredients together produces a quality dish.
Some Nigella vibes, I think, probably. You're nodding furiously.
I completely agree with Ali, and we've seen similar really great results from just using our own first-party audiences at The Telegraph. Uplifts for brands of up to 60% higher action intent of people actually taking an action as a result of us applying the right data to the right brand, which is fantastic. But also on the data matching side of things too, we've been doing that for a little while and we've learned a lot along the way. But similarly, where we have applied that successfully using matching, using modelling, pairing it up with our first party audiences. Again, we had a campaign where we did that is still our best ever digital campaign in terms of brand uplifts, like up to 6 times higher than benchmarks. It's fantastic for brands that they can achieve that. And I'm seeing much more engagement from advertisers in wanting to do things like this, which is really encouraging. But I think as well for us, it's reassuring to have that proof that it does work, and that by investing in these the right technologies for the right use cases and applying them really judiciously, you can get these fantastic results. You're getting better results for everybody.
It's called the power of premium publishing.
Clearly, a sort of superpower they've got. What else is it though? What is it about these premium publishers that is so unique and advertisers should be taking advantage of?
I think we have been for years. If you think about quality content, has always been valued. And I think sometimes we get caught up in this digital sphere, but for years we've always crafted out very bespoke partnerships with publishers. These partnerships still happen on consistent basis. We value the brands that these publishers represent, the audiences they can reach, the trust that they have built up with these audiences over time. And that's why advertisers again and again want to lean into premium content, and why we want to support it. Like, a key part of our responsible investment framework is the need to support responsible journalism. That's in there as a mandate as a group as we move forward, of like the power of great quality content and publishers and the need to support that.
Yeah. I'm slightly playing devil's advocate, but do you think quality content has always been supported?
I think as a whole, yeah, absolutely. You still have those direct relationships. You wouldn't have those direct relationships and long direct partnerships with clients and agencies about that, really. I guess the only thing you would question is that bottom layer of the OMP, really, where it can be picked off quite cheaply of the unsold inventory. But the tiers above that exist, and we continue to have relationships with clients and advertisers, as we always have done.
Yeah,
it's just that digital has grown, audiences have grown, there is a lot of inventory out there, really. But they realise that at the top of the tree, there's very little that can beat quality kind of content, whether that is journalism, whether that is broadcasting. It exists.
Yeah. In violent agreement.
I hope so. Yes, exactly. I think quality pervades all, and while there's always going to be new things and new platforms and things going on, that will hopefully persist if adequately supported, which it sounds like it is being. I think your point on trust was really crucial, that having these people come to the internet for a purpose, and that's usually to read something or to do something. So they're coming with that level of intention, and we have that trust with our audiences, which is proven and is fantastic. But I think also the other side of it is the attention that people give to when they're reading the news, when they're reading quality journalism, is unrivaled. You can't get that same level of attention on social or on other platforms, because people are sort of, their minds are in a different state, and there's been psychological studies on this as well. So I think that question of trust, but also the engagement that you get with people, you can't really mimic elsewhere.
The attention debate feels like it's just swirled around for a long time. It gathers some traction and then it goes off into the sort of trough of disillusionment, and then we get very excited about it again. Why is that happening? It feels like a very sensible metric. Attention, certainly better than things like click-through rates and all this other vanity stuff that we use. Why is attention not caught on?
I dealt with it first at the Financial Times maybe about 10 to 12 years ago, when we produced a model called cost per hour, where you could buy campaigns based on the total amount of time that an audience was exposed to a campaign, really. Not all impressions are valued equally.
Yeah.
An ad that's in for 1 second, should that not be valued lower than something that's in for 30 seconds? So it's selling in that.
Yeah.
Attention is a sign of quality. It's a link to journalism. It's a link to the quality of whether it's informative or entertaining. So honestly, that kind of gives, the better the content, it grabs someone's attention. The ad will be in view for a longer period of time.
Yeah.
That gives the opportunity for that to be recalled, understood and influenced.
Yeah.
And it's a really powerful metric.
Yeah, we don't pay attention to things we're not interested in or don't like or don't entertain us, I guess.
I think it will. It's just taking a bit of time to catch on. I think we're making progress within that. Certainly from a Group M point of view, the way that we approach our inclusion lists, which I can speak a bit more about later on, but was trying to factor in attention as part of that scoring methodology. And I think one of the challenges has been, if you look at like the core ad verification vendors, attention hasn't always been wrapped up within that, and quite often that is the scoring methodology that a lot of clients are using. We're seeing like progress being made in that area, and I think it's only a matter of time, because you can't purely go on viewability when you get varying formats that have differing viewability standards. So I think it'll be a combination of looking at various things, and this is the way we approach our methodology, about the viewability, how's this working from an attention point of view, and then over time, as we progress insight into sustainability metrics, looking to add that in as well, so it becomes like a balanced view of the inventory you're buying.
Well, tell us a bit more about site lists. You talked about inclusion lists there. How do you guys go about, well, maybe for the uninitiated, explain what they are and then how you go about putting them together?
Yeah, I mean, a Group M perspective, for years we have been running exclusion lists, and a big part of what we do as a team is that centralisation and think about what is the best practice we can bring forward. And inclusion lists were always one of those, when you spoke to the different agency groups and different client teams, of how you arrived at the inclusion list process, it varied from agency to agency, from clients to clients. And what we want to do is really standardise that process and think about this from that kind of responsible investment framework as a North Star, and approach it from, like, what could be best practice here? And this is where we looked at, what does the data actually show us? So let's remove bias out of it. And you had studies from the A&A showing that the average domain size is around 44,000 domains. And what we had was information from a lot of the ad verification vendors, which we could aggregate at source and get that macro view. And we put that in a proprietary tool called Radar. Mm-hmm. And from that viewpoint, it showed us that you don't need to be utilising 44,000 domains. The vast Surprise. Majority of delivery happens within the top 250 domains. And if you can get down to about 97% delivery, that happens across about 5,000 domains. So with that data in mind, we were thinking, well, could we start to formulate an inclusion list and look to score all the domains based on those variable principles, like what's the IAB viewability scores against those domains? Is it shares a system sophisticated and valid traffic, etc., to then start to think about how we score those domains. And what we wanted to ensure, and going back to those principles of that investment framework, is we were being inclusive as well. So purposefully carving out D and I sites, so there was a representation within that overarching inclusion list. And if you ask clients what they want out of an inclusion list, they want to ensure it's brand safe, it's got the ability to scale, and it will drive performance. And that's where we came with this concept of, can we significantly reduce it? And within that helps to mitigate some risks against MFAs and other sites out there in market. So that's been our approach, and that's been adopted. I'd like to say about 90% plus of clients now are utilising that as their inclusion list. And then they tailor within that. What was an important part of testing with our Nexus division is identifying feedback for them is, like, we need to be able to identify, like, what's IAB gold standard within that. Yeah. And then so we've started to classify that inclusion list, putting in that level of transparency and then two-level IAB taxonomy within it to then make that list, whilst it's brand safe at the moment, also perhaps more brand suitable, and that can be done at the agency level.
Yeah, which is incredibly nuanced. Great shout out for the IAB UK gold standard as well. Very good. It has its fans. MFAs, Mick just mentioned them, made for advertising sites. Not good for anyone. Bad news for everyone, aren't they? Probably.
I'll give an answer that you can probably predict, which is to avoid this happening, come directly to premium publishers. Surprise. But really, I think having those direct relationships with trust, with adequate levels of scrutiny on both sides, transparency, that's the way to achieve quality. I think with digital in general, I think we're talking about this before, it's amazing in the way it's scaled up and you can access so many different things in so many different ways. It's always evolving and changing and it's wonderful. It's so easy in some ways, but it's also so opaque in others. And I think it's that opacity that is one of the major pitfalls. And I think the whole MFA situation really speaks to that, is the other side of the easiness coin. But I think, you know, where advertising thrives in our experience is having those direct relationships. And also, it's the only way that you can guarantee you're getting inventory and activations that are not only verified to what you want them to be, but also tailored to your campaign goals. If you're having a discussion with the expert or the owner of the media owner that you're talking to, that's where you can get something that's exactly right for you, where you can get those results that you want that are going to give you the better outcomes. If you're going for the broad brushstrokes route, you're probably not going to achieve that same level that you want to.
The environment is so important. That is one thing that I think that gets missed. We search for audiences, but we don't really care about where they are, and that seems to feel how an MFA's kind of gun. But environment is so important to a brand. It can damage or enhance your brand. I don't want to go, I'll go back 40 years. One of my favourite kind of research example was a study that Vogue did. They did something called the Little Black Dress Test, and they created a make-believe brand. And it was a beautiful model in a black dress, and they put it in the pages of Vogue magazine, and they put it in the pages of some more down-market weekly magazines. And they simply went to the audience, how much do you think this dress costs?
Right. Mm.
The ones who saw it in the weeklies, the more down market ones, thought it was a lovely dress, high street dress, worth £40-50. The exact same ad in Vogue, readers thought it was the design address and were £400 or £500. The brand association, the rub-off effect, and the idea of the environment you sit in is really important, because it can enhance and damage it based on the user experience and the quality that it's alongside.
Yeah, whether it's a media myth or not, but the reason Jaguar used to park cars in Mayfair was for exact reason. You hope they feel a bit more expensive. They park them in slightly more salubrious places in North or South London, either are fine, then maybe. Is there ever a danger, and I think it's slightly antagonistic here to Camilla, is there ever a danger that all digital gets tarred with the brush, that it's all bad, it's all opaque, and actually rather than the money flowing to premium trusted partners, actually people go, I'm just not going to spend money in digital at all?
I don't expect that to happen. I think none of us want that to happen.
Where would they spend
it? Yeah, but you just have to look at the amount of time we spend online, not just with publishers, through broadcasting, through audio. All the different media are moving closer to digital, where it's outdoor. Digital spend's going to be spent in different ways.
Yeah.
Because there's so many ways you can actually target audiences or execute going forward. It's going to increase in one pod.
Yeah.
Maybe what the definition of what digital is going to change, perhaps, really.
Good point.
But I don't think there's any worry about digital spend drying up.
Thank you, Ali, Camilla. Thank you very much indeed, Mick. Everyone, give him a big hand. The Independent's Alistair Smith, Telegraph Media Group's Camilla Child, and Mick Clare from Group M in front of a live audience at the Last Thursday Club. What really struck me about the whole conversation is that it just makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? First party data, quality context, and really, really engaged audiences just can't help but add up to this incredibly powerful proposition, can it? And talking of powerful propositions, Engage is just a few weeks away and promises to be a half day smorgasbord of digital delights. We'll put a link in the show notes so you can check out the agenda and book your spot to join us on the 4th of June at Soho Place. Don't forget that advertisers and agency members book for free, and all IB members get a discounted rate. That's it for this week. Thanks to Mick, Camilla, and Alistair. And of course, thank you very much for listening.
IAB UK, building a better future for digital advertising for the benefit of everyone.